así, solo así.
Yourself. Where are you from? Who are you?
Okay, I'm, like you said, I'm Paola Baez Perez. I'm from Miami, Florida. My family is hails from the great island of Puerto Rico. I'm a student at New College of Florida. This is my first year. I'm very interested in radio and Latin America in general.
There's something really new here with you. The first Florida native to run a show. Hey, welcome to Florida Caribe.
Look at that, Florida and Caribe, both in the same person.
Wonderful. All right. First, I need to correct something we had in our last show. I announced a talk by a key peace negotiator for the Colombian government, organized by the Sarasota World Affairs Council. The negotiator, Frank Pearl Gonzalez, was originally scheduled to talk about the peace process between the Colombian government and the FARC rebels yesterday night at New College, but he had to postpone because he was called back to the negotiation table in Havana. Fortunately, he committed to a new date next week. That's November 30th, 5:30 at Sudakov Hall, New College. The event is free, but you need to reserve. If you want to do so, go to www.sarasotawac.org. Again, the website is www.sarasotawac.org. And here's the reason why he had to postpone. In response to a call by the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia to accelerate the peace process, Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos announced Friday that he had dispatched his brother Enrique Santos as his personal messenger to meet with guerrilla leader Timoleon Jimenez, also known as Timoshenko, in Havana. The president explained that the main objective of the visit is to propose a special conclave where negotiators would not leave the negotiation table until outstanding points in the peace process were resolved. I'm quoting Santos here, we want, and this is the intention of the Colombian government, to accelerate the negotiations because the faster we end the conflict, the fewer victims there will be. Earlier this week, the head of the FARC published a letter directed at President Santos questioning the attitude taken by government negotiators, accusing them of deliberately stalling the process of talks. Meanwhile, some 1,000 activist organizations in Colombia in an open letter are accusing the government of increasing military action, possibly ending a ceasefire, and expressing concern over the rising mobilization of right-wing paramilitary groups. Negotiations are due to conclude by March 23, 2016, which is, by the way, what makes it so exciting to have a key negotiator here in Sarasota. And President Santos has suggested that deadline is non-negotiable. Thus far, negotiations have been organized into rounds, with negotiators taking regular breaks. The conclave proposed by Santos, similar to the process used by the Catholic Church to select a pope, would require negotiators from both sides to remain at the table as long as necessary. The president's personal envoy, Enrique Santos, is a journalist by trade and has been a crucial figure in the Colombian peace process. The president's announcement comes just days after he declared he would not extradite Timoshenko to the United States and that the $5 million reward offered by Washington has to go. Timoshenko is wanted by Washington for a variety of alleged crimes, including drug trafficking across Latin America and into the United States. Meanwhile, the FARC is proposing the creation of a peace fund fed, among others, with U.S. military aid for the government of Colombia. The FONAPAS, as they call the fund, should be set up for 10 years to implement a peace agreement, facilitating the return of fighters to civilian life, compensating victims, and defusing conflicts over land and other properties. The FONAPAS should be funded with the equivalent of at least 4% of GDP, the FARC suggests. In the past 15 years, the United States have funneled $8 billion to the Colombian military, to give you an impression of what kinds of monies are at stake here. The South American country is the third biggest recipient worldwide of U.S. military aid. The FARC also made first proposals on how it could turn from an armed rebel group into a political movement that supports grassroots democracy and communal economies. Former FARC fighters, including current prisoners, should have a right to a job, health insurance, social security, and housing, the rebels demand. All FARC fighters should be subject to amnesty and none should be extradited to the United States. These are the demands by the FARC. On to probably the biggest event of the last weekend, the elections in Argentina. And a turnaround after 12 years of left-leaning populism under the Kirchners, husband and wife, Argentinian voters elected a conservative, neoliberal-style president. In the presidential runoff elections in Argentina on Sunday, Mauricio Macri won with 51.4% of the votes. The mayor of Buenos Aires and businessman surprised observers by beating Peronist candidate Daniel Scioli, who had the support of President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and the Peronist election machine. Macri emphasized the prospect of change and the need of economic reforms in his campaign, while assuring he would continue the social welfare programs built under the Kirchners. The new president also announced he would move away from Argentina's close alliance with Venezuela. In fact, one of the first things he will do is petition the Mercosur trade bloc to exclude Venezuela, and instead move Argentina closer to the neoliberal Pacific Alliance. However, Macri is not in a strong position as his Cambiemos Alliance only captured 89 of 257 seats in the parliament. The largest political party still is the Peronist Rafael Correa will not run again in 2017, the left-leaning populist told the National Assembly of his country. His Alianza País party announced its support for the longtime leader's move, saying that new leaders must emerge now. This is not the first time Correa has announced he would step aside. In May, he said he would only be a candidate if a quote-unquote extreme political situation arises, making it necessary. Relations between government and opposition took a turn for the worse in Ecuador since a coup attempt in 2010. Correa initiated a discussion over lifting a two-term limit for all elected officials in Ecuador's constitution. Since the governing party has a two-thirds majority in the parliament, the opposition is asking for a referendum. Correa has been very popular, as 1 million Ecuadorians were able to leave poverty behind during his years in power. The minimum wage is up 80%, and spending on education and health care have risen considerably. And then Venezuela. President Nicolas Maduro, after news broke that the NSA has been spying on state oil company PDVSA, announced that relations with the United States would go through a comprehensive review. The Venezuelan Foreign Ministry had handed a note of protest to the U.S. Department of State. PDVSA is the world's fifth largest corporation. Venezuela owns the world's largest oil reserves, and oil exports make up 96% of the Venezuelan government's revenues. Whistleblower Edward Snowden produced an NSA document classified as top secret that was published by U.S. internet portal The Intercept and TV network Telesur. According to the document, the NSA in 2011 gained deep access to internal communications after acquiring 900 usernames and passwords of PDVSA employees. The aim was to not only spy on the oil concern, but also place malware in the internal network, according to those documents. In a 2009 diplomatic memo published by WikiLeaks, since 2011, the U.S. government imposed additional sanctions, money laundering, and corruption investigations on Venezuela, increasing economic pressures on the country already squeezed by a dramatic drop in oil prices. Challenged by Maduro to comment, State Department John Kirby did not deny the content of the document. He only said the United States did not seek any economic advantage and that the issue would be treated through diplomatic channels. The last time the U.S. government made a similar denial regarding its electronic snooping was in 2013, when it became known the NSA had been spying on internal communications of Brazilian state oil company Petrobras. As the Chavista government is besieged by an economic depression, the political tide in Venezuela is turning. The country is headed towards a parliamentary election on December 6th that could be won by the conservative opposition the first time since the late 1990s. Meanwhile, Maduro is making sure voters get the message that his government is the one driving welfare programs that have made a difference in the lives of poor Venezuelans. In a high-profile event in the city of Maracaibo, the president delivered the 800,000 apartment of the Gran Misión Vivienda Social housing program. Despite the dropping oil price, his government is sticking to the goal of building 3 million homes by 2018. Maduro said the program is partly funded with Chinese loans. All right, this was the roundup of news. Paola, any comments about the changing tides in Latin America?
Well, I mean, it's very interesting. Like, I like the fact that it resembles a lot of the retrospective voting model that we're learning about in American politics, where when there's a specific way of governing and things start to go bad, for example, the economy starts to go bad, people kind of go, all right, well, since this way of doing it didn't work out, let's just vote for the other end of the spectrum and see how that goes for 10, 15 years. And then it just keeps going back and forth, especially with the economy. It's funny because the way in America, the way it works is the business cycle kind of dictates the economy, but then the politics doesn't really correlate, but then people vote one way or another, either way.
Trying the alternatives.
Right, yeah.
All right, I guess we're witnessing a change of the tides here. Remember when we started this show, Florida Caribe, 10 mm-hmm. years ago, the tide was going exactly the opposite way. So, interesting times again. We will be back after a piece of music here with one of the foremost experts in the United States of Cuban baseball. So, stay tuned.
Outside, hear it from the inside.
WMMR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida. And our topic now is Cuban baseball, which is undergoing considerable change. The best Cuban athletes are now playing in pro leagues around the globe, but the U.S. Major League Baseball is still playing Cold War games, forcing Cuban players to defect, separating them from their families, and taking great risks. We have with us on the phone Peter Bjarkman, a journalist, book author, and one of the foremost experts of Cuban baseball in the United States. Peter, welcome to the Florida Caribe Show.
Well, it's pleasure to talk to you.
Let's first get into Cuban baseball itself. The fans of baseball in Cuba are kind of suffering right now because the juggernaut that used to be the Cuban national team is kind of lagging right now. They were just eliminated by South Korea in a major tournament, and they lost to the Netherlands in the World Baseball Classic. What's going on in Cuban baseball right now, Peter?
Well, they've lost so many top-line players due to the defections, but also it's not only the top-line players that have left. They've had so many young players leave that it's really kind of taken the heart out of their competitive league. So the national team has been weakened. This is a large part of the story. Of course, the other part of the story is that Cuba used to dominate all these international tournaments up through the late 1990s. Basically, for two reasons. They were playing against lesser competition. They weren't playing the top professional players. They weren't playing AAA players or Major League players like they do now. And they were playing in the international baseball that featured aluminum bats. So it was a very different world than it is now. After 1999, when the professional players came into international tournaments, Cuba slid a little bit, although they remained very strong and very competitive, and were still, even though they didn't win every tournament, they were still usually in the finals. But yes, the defections have really taken a toll the last couple of years.
What about Cuba's National League?
Well, this is the problem. The league itself has slipped drastically. I'm down there quite a bit. I see, probably 15 or 20 games there every year, and many more on television from up here on the Internet. And up until about 3 years ago, the league remained pretty consistent. It wasn't quite as strong as it was 5 or 6 years ago, but up until about 2 years ago, it was still very strong. But the last 2 years, it's really taken a hit. So what you have now is some very top-level players still in that league, major league-level players playing on the same field with other players who might not make university teams here in the United States. So the play is very, very consistent, and it's difficult for them to have their top players ready for these international tournaments to then make the transition and play against basically major league players when they've been playing in a league all year where the top pitchers throw 80, most of the top pitchers throw 85 miles an hour and where the defense is very inconsistent, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, help me understand what's going on here. Cuba baseball is a big political deal. I remember in the run-up of the economic reforms, there were these consulting processes, discussion processes involving millions of Cubans on a neighborhood level, on a workplace level, and infallibly the topic that came up in those discussions was how to reform Cuban baseball. Now, the government has made several interesting moves that look very radical from a Cuban perspective. One is the best players are now earning salaries, which openly recognizes the fact of pro sports. And number two, they're allowing the best players to play abroad in professional teams.
Those are both efforts to try to stem the tide of the defections and keep some of the better players home, give them some financial motivation for staying home. The Cuban players have been paid for years, so it wasn't that they were not professional in the sense that they weren't paid. They were paid. They were full-time athletes. They did receive a salary. The problem is, from our perspective, they did not play in a free market system or a capitalist system as we know it. So all the players basically received the same salary. The salaries were very low, and they were essentially paid just like any other government worker. All the teams are owned by the league, owned by the government, and so there are no individual franchises, so they don't have contracts in the sense that we know contracts for professional athletes up here and so forth. But they had to try to make some adjustments a couple of years back when the defections really started to really spiral out of control. And so they came up with this plan to send some of their top players to the league in Japan. The reason they wanted to work with Japan was that the Japanese league playing in the summer was willing to allow those few stars that signed to play over there come back and play in Cuba in the wintertime, which in, of course, Major League Baseball, that wouldn't happen because once a Major League team has the player's contract, they're not going to let him play a full season in the winter and risk injury and play 200 or 220 games a year and so forth. So this is why they turned toward Japan. It hasn't been overly successful. It certainly hasn't stemmed the tide of young players leaving because two or three or four top stars are picked, you know, each year the last couple of years to go to Japan, but most of the players in Kansas see that they're not going to have that possibility. So the enticement of the big money in professional baseball in the United States is wearing more and more of them away.
Now, they're also playing in other leagues, in Mexico, in Canada, in Europe. So you don't qualify that as a success at this point?
Well, what happened was they were first going to send, when they first announced this plan in September 2013, the idea was to work with the Mexican League, and particularly with the Campeche team in Mexico, and several of the top Cuban players were sent over there, including the big home run hitter, what happened is that the Mexican League is affiliated with North American Professional Baseball. And we now get into another issue we haven't talked about yet, and that is the requirement of the major leagues and also of the United States Treasury Department because of the blockade.
Let's keep that for a little later. It's first.
Right. But the issue was, of course, a couple of top players who were sent to Japan immediately. Organized baseball in the U.S. said, no, these players can't play in Mexico. They can't play in the Mexican League because it's affiliated with North American professional baseball. And so they have to have third country residence. They can't live in Cuba and play in Mexico. So this sabotaged the attempt to try to play, to send some of the players to the Mexican League. So they ended up working with Japan. And as you mentioned, they're also sending some players to the Winter League in Colombia. And also they had four players playing in the Canadian-American League up in Quebec this past summer, but that's a very low-level minor league, so that is really not going to give them the chance to prepare their players at the top level that they would have if they were playing in someplace like Japan, for example, where the Japanese league is almost the equivalent of the major leagues.
Now, one of the requirements, as you said, of the Cuban Baseball Federation is that players who go to play abroad have to be available for the National League season and for national team games. Is that something they could possibly move away from?
Well, the reason that they want to do that, of course, is they're trying to keep their league intact and keep it as high level as possible, and they're trying to have the players available for the national team because, as you mentioned before, baseball is hugely important. It's hugely political in Cuba, and one of the very few places where the Cuban government over the last 20 or 30 years has had much international success is on the baseball field. And so they want to keep those stars available for the national team. They take great pride in winning these tournaments. It's a great propaganda issue for them. If they don't have those players coming back, if the players leave and simply are gone for good, then they pretty much lost any national baseball at home. And this is what they're trying to prevent. But little by little, the whole thing is eroding around them. So they're losing it anyway, despite their best efforts.
Now, let's go into the U.S. side of the equation.
Right.
I said in the introduction that MLB is still playing Cold War games. Am I off with that comment?
No, I mean, I think this is correct, although it has to be understood in its context. As far as the players defecting from Cuba, there's no evidence that Major League Baseball in any way or any officials of Major League Baseball have been directly involved in enticing players to leave. What they have done is they've encouraged it, and they've made it necessary through the conditions that Major League Baseball has for Cuban players who do get to the major leagues. Not only the conditions that Major League Baseball has, but I mentioned a few moments ago the U.S. Treasury Department and the blockade. Because of the blockade, no professional athlete earning money or professional of any other kind earning money in Cuba can send that money back to Cuba. So the players have fans want them to, because Major League Baseball currently still does not have an international player draft. So unlike the players coming out of college in the United States who have to go through a draft system and cannot choose the team they want to play for and cannot negotiate with the highest bidder, but have to, you know, go through the same kind of draft you have like in professional basketball or professional football. But the international players, if they're coming from a third country, if they don't live in the United States, they don't live in Cuba, they can negotiate with the highest bidder. So those players, even the ones who've defected while they're on U.S. soil, the agents immediately move them to the Dominican Republic or to Costa Rica or to some other location so that they can qualify as an international free agent. So this has encouraged the defections all along the line. And, of course, the players have been also smuggled out of Cuba with the knowledge of...
They're very unsavory connections there.
Exactly. And with the knowledge and even cooperation of some Major League Baseball player agents who are licensed by Major League Baseball. So in this direct sense, Major League Baseball has had its hands a little bit dirty with all these defections. And as you mentioned, very safe, unsafe situations with players being smuggled to Mexico by crime elements. The story broke a year and a half ago that Yasiel Puig, and how he was kidnapped by one criminal group from another group and was held hostage. And this is very dangerous. But for fortunate, some of these players have not already been killed. The reason they haven't is that they are just too valuable an item to you know, not be kept alive because of the contracts they may be able to sign and the money that hopefully will filter back to those criminal elements.
Now, there has been some political pressure in the United States to change that. Interestingly, the Florida legislature passed a law that would prohibit MLB teams to continue following these practices. Can you explain?
Well, yes, they attempted to do that. Of course, the problem here is that one state cannot control Major League Baseball, which doesn't operate only in one state, so that really didn't have much of a lasting effect. I think Major League Baseball itself wants to get out from under this situation. It's become kind of a nightmare, the bad publicity for Major League Baseball, but also the staggering salaries that are being thrown by some teams and some of these players. I think there are officials in Major League Baseball who would like to see this thing somehow normalized, either through setting up some kind of an international draft or coming to some kind of a political agreement with Cuba so that the defections will stop and there's some kind of normalization in relationships. I do have a theory about how this is all going to eventually play itself out, and if you want, we can go there, but it is only a theory. Nobody really knows how this is going
to
work out.
I would love to hear your theory, but let's first go into the reason why MLB is where it is. How did they get into this situation in the first place? Is this all about money? I mean, one of the reasons the Cuban defection system worked well for MLB teams and MLB was they could save on the transfer fees. Usually when a Japanese player transfers to the MLB, MLB teams pay a sizable fee to the professional league in Japan. They don't have to do that, obviously, with Cuba. So is that possibly one of the reasons they continue with that system?
Well, absolutely. And, of course, now you're leading right into what I'll get to in a moment in terms of how I think this is going to play out, because I think the Japanese model is what you're eventually going to see. Yes, Major League Baseball has had it good right now. If the players defect and then suddenly are out there on the free agent market, then they're free for the picking, and individual teams can negotiate with them. And this is what, of course, led to the extremely high salaries and the speculation on some of these players, some of whom may have been well overpaid. We hear about how, Abreu and Yasuo
talking to Peter Bjarkman, journalist, book author, foremost expert on Cuban baseball in the United States. Peter, talk to us about how this problem could be solved.
Well, I think one of the things that will probably happen down the road, the Cubans need to have their players under contract, first of all. This is another reason, of course, why when they defect and they're just out there as free agents, they're free picking for Major League Baseball because they have no contracts in Cuba since they all play for the government. Contracts are set up as we know them. They have a capitalist society to protect basically one owner or one corporation from another corporation. The government owns everything, then contracts really aren't necessary. So the players don't have contracts. Cuba will have to put their players under some kind of contracts, and those contracts will specify a certain period of obligation within the Cuban League. This is, as you mentioned, what Japan has. So a player can, once he's under contract and playing in Japan, he can simply decide that he's going to leave Japan and go to the U.S. and play for a major league team until his contract period expires. So the Cubans will have to institute some kind of contracts, and then if there are normal relations between the two countries, and that would mean that Cuban contracts would have to be recognized by any business in the United States, then we're going to have a different situation. And probably what the Cubans will do is what the Japanese have done, and that is allow those players, after they fulfill their initial contract obligation of 5 or 6 years, whatever it is, become free agents, and then MLB teams will be able to bid on them, but will have to pay a posting fee to the Cuban League in order to be able to then negotiate with the player individually. So there will be an inflow of capital into Cuba. They will not be able to keep their players forever, but they'll have some stability because the players will play there for 5 or 6 years. You won't have all these young 18 and 19-year-old players trying to sneak out of Cuba so that they can maybe fulfill their dream of playing in the major leagues. Many of whom, by the way, we've had over 100 defectors this year. Probably 15 or 20 of those will find their way to the major leagues. Probably 60 or 70 of them will never sign a professional contract because they're not at the level to play in top-level professional baseball in the United States.
Now, MLB is not the only factor. Another interesting factor in baseball politics is the players' union. Do you know what kind of attitude they have towards this challenge and resolving this problem?
Well, I'm not sure they have a plan right now yet. I think that everything is in a state of flux. I haven't been as directly in contact with, let's say, the players' union or officials of Major League Baseball as I have been with people on the Cuban end. And one thing I can tell you about Cuba is not only the baseball situation, but the whole movement towards some kind of a political detente, which began with Obama's announcement a year ago in December, left the Cubans completely confused, the Cuban government officials completely confused. They weren't ready for this. They didn't see it coming. Their whole system has been based on the Cold War mentality between the two countries. And from what I can gather, talking to people in Cuba, I was just down here 2 weeks ago, particularly the baseball people, they don't have a plan right now. They don't know what they're going to do about all of this. They're really pretty much in a state of confusion. And I think that there's a lot of confusion on both ends right now because this is such a new development and such a new scenario. And there's always been the feeling about Cuba, you know, here in the United States that, well, we will decide what we do about Cuba. MLB will decide how they're going to handle the Cuban situation. We often forget that the Cubans will have a major, major say in all of this and how it plays out. They're not going to just open their doors and welcome MLB to come in there and set up academies and take all the players out of there and turn Cuba into another Dominican Republic because baseball is simply too important to them.
We're talking to Peter Bjarkman, journalist, book author, expert on Cuban baseball. If you have a question to Peter, comments, give us a call at 941-954-8636 or send me an email to Huiti, that's H-U-I, T as in Tom, Z as in Zebra, I at AOL.com. Again, that's Huiti at AOL.com or our studio line at 941-954-8636. Hang in there, Peter. We'll be back in a minute.
dicen que la distancia es el olvido, pero yo no concibo esa razón, porque yo seguiré siendo el cautivo de los caprichos de tu corazón. Supiste esclarecer mis pensamientos, me diste la verdad que yo soy, ahuyentaste de mí los sufrimientos. En la primera noche que te amé, hoy mi plana se viste de amargura, porque tu barca tiene que partir a cruzar otros mares de locura. Cuida que no naufrague tu vivir cuando el sol se esté apagando y te sientas cansado de vagar. Piensa que yo por ti estaré esperando hasta que tú decidas regresar.
Show on WSLR 96.5 LPFM. We have with us Peter Bjarkman, foremost expert in the United States on Cuban baseball. Peter, we have a question online by email from Pedro in Sarasota. He asks, will Cuba end up being a farm team market for major league teams? What are they doing to remain a power? What's going for them?
Quite what he means by the first part of the question, but if he's referring to the possibility of a minor league team being placed in Cuba, I think that's what he's suggesting there. This is not a reasonable possibility anywhere in the near future just because of the financial infrastructure of the country. Even at the lower minor league levels now, it takes a considerable financial investment. You need corporate sponsors. You need to be able to sell tickets at fairly elevated prices and so forth, and this just isn't going to happen in Havana, which is a third world city. So I don't think that's in the near future. As far as what the Cuban government is trying to do and how this is going to play out, this is what we've just been talking about. I think they have a very difficult situation to try to keep the players at home. Now, the thing that's happened that's so important here is that up until maybe 6 or 7 years ago, for a young Cuban athlete, for a Cuban baseball player, there was no greater honor, there was no greater goal than to wear the national team uniform, to play for the country, to play in these international tournaments. They were like rock stars on the island. They were the biggest heroes in Cuba because baseball was so important there. But then when the national team started losing in the early 2000s because of the change in the level of play in international baseball, and so they suddenly, people at home were scratching their heads, and what's wrong? These players aren't as good as they used to be 10 years ago, 12 years ago. So their status began to slip a little bit. And then when players like Aroldis
team. That's quite a big difference. Peter, you will actually be in Sarasota December 6th, 2 p.m. at the Fogartyville Community Center. This is next door to our radio studio here at 525 Kumquat Court. So there will be a chance for our listeners to talk to you directly. If they want to prepare, you have published books. Tell us about the books that are already out there.
Well, the two books on Cuba that are already out there, I originally started my Cuba adventure back in the late 1990s with a photographer, Mark Rucker, and he and I went, starting in 1997, to Cuba and collected photos and did a coffee table history book on the history of Cuban baseball. It's called Smoke, The Romance and Lore of Cuban Baseball, and that's been out there since the late 1990s. It's really a beautiful coffee table picture book, and it takes Cuban baseball up through the time of the 1996 Olympics. And then I wrote a full academic history, which is called The History of Cuban Baseball, 1864 to 2006, which is now also available in paperback. It's from McFarland Publishers. You can find it online. So those are the two books I've done in the past. I have a new book coming out now on this very issue we're talking about, on the whole phenomenon of Cuban defectors and its connection with the history of the U.S.-Cuba Cold War relations. It's called Cuba's Baseball Defectors Inside Story, and that will be out from Roland Littlefield Publishers in May. It's in press right now.
So you've finished the manuscript. It's already done.
Oh, yes. It's in press. It's waiting for my proof copies now to do final corrections and hopefully, yeah.
You also have a blog, Baseball de Cuba. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's actually more than a blog. I work with a Cuban who left Cuba legally 11 years ago, lives in the Washington, D.C. area, Ray Otero, and he started the Baseball de Cuba website. It's baseball spelled in English, de Cuba, all one word, and we have probably the most complete coverage of Cuban League baseball anywhere, including the Cuban Baseball Federation website itself. We carry many other games from Cuba on linked to Cuban television, so you can see them on the internet on our website. We have complete coverage of the Cuban League and the Cuban national team, both in English and Spanish, so anybody interested in Cuban baseball should go and take a look at that website.
Peter, how did you get into all this? You're based in Indiana.
Yes, my wife's on the faculty at Purdue University. I used to be, until I left Purdue in 1987 to start writing full-time, and I started writing the baseball history books. I did a lot of stuff on the major leagues and also some basketball. And then with the 1994 Major League Baseball strike, I got a little bit disillusioned with Major League Baseball. And right after that, I mentioned before Mark Rucker, who is the photographer who I did the Smoke book with, he contacted me at the time of the Atlanta Olympics in 1996 and said, you know, you speak Spanish, I don't. I want to go to Cuba. I want to collect photographs. I want to do a coffee table book on Cuban baseball. And so that's where we started. And I fell in love with the people of the island. I have reservations about the political system, but that's another issue. I have reservations about our political system here, too. So, I just kept going back and did these other books and have many friends in Cuba now. And I've continued to follow the national teams. I go to almost all of the international tournaments that Cuba plays in overseas and cover those for the website that we were just talking about. So I've been very close to Cuban baseball now since 1996.
What do you recommend for Cuba visitors who actually want to watch a game? I don't know, the Industriales or the Cuban national team, if it plays in Cuba, how do you get a ticket? How do you get into those stadiums?
Well, there are no advance sales for any Cuban League games. You just walk up to the stadium, and very rarely in Havana is the stadium, because it's so large, ever completely full, except maybe during the playoffs. So you can always get tickets. You can always get into the games. The interesting thing about tickets for baseball games in Cuba, you know, up until about 12 or 15 years ago, all baseball games were free, just like all public events, ballet, any sporting events. They were always free in Cuba under their socialist system. But they started charging about 15 years ago when the economy started getting worse after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so now Cubans pay 3 Cuban pesos, which is about 15 cents, to go to the game. But foreigners are charged 3 CUD. before the season starts, so it's very difficult to plan from outside of Cuba a trip around the baseball schedule. And this year they started the season particularly early in September. They usually go from late November until April, but this year the season started early. They had a month off for this tournament that they just held in Asia. Now they're going to have another month off in February during the Caribbean Series. So it's really the best way to follow what the schedule is going to be is to, again, go to our website at Baseball de Cuba. But the hardest part of seeing baseball in Cuba for a tourist is figuring out what the schedule is and planning in advance to be there when baseball is being played.
We're talking to Peter Bjarkman, baseball expert on Cuba. There's a question from Mike from Bradenton via email. Will we see spring training going to Cuba? Will we lose the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Baltimore Orioles?
Well, it's going to be a long, long time before you'll see any teams holding a full spring training in Cuba. First of all, there's the political issues of whether the Cuban government is going to welcome that and allow that. But also right now, there are no fields, there are no facilities that would be of major league caliber for a major league team to play down there. This is the problem. There's been talk about the possibility of staging a couple of individual games, spring training games there. No U.S. major league team has played there since the one game the Baltimore Orioles played there in 1999. And even at that time when the Orioles went down there and played, they had to MLB had to go in and refurbish the big stadium in Havana, put padding on the outfield walls, recreate the infield and so forth before they even let major league players play on that field. So whether or not there might be a couple of spring training games either this spring or next spring, that's being negotiated right now between the Cuban government and MLB. I don't know whether that will happen, but any full-fledged spring training camp down there, I don't see that in the next, I don't know how many years. The infrastructure, anybody who's been to Cuba knows, the infrastructure is in real bad shape. It's a third world country because of the blockade. Also, there has not been much development in terms of hotels and transportation facilities and so forth. So we're not going to have an overnight change. This was one of the interesting things when Obama made his announcement. Everybody thought, oh, we'll get on a plane and we'll all go to Cuba as tourists. Well, first of all, the travel ban has not been lifted yet, but secondly, there's no hotel space in Havana right now. I mean, it's very difficult to make reservations to stay in Havana because the hotels are so limited at this point.
We're talking to Peter Bjarkman. In fact, one of the local teams here, the Tampa Bay Rays, were drafted in a lottery by the MLB to play an exhibition game in Cuba. How likely is it for this to pan out, and what does it depend on?
Well, MLB is talking about that, and they've already, as you just mentioned, they've mentioned a couple of teams. Originally, it was talk about the Baltimore Orioles and the Red Sox. Those teams wanted to go down there because they had some Cuban defectors, and they thought it would be great to showcase them in Cuba. But, of course, the Cuban government is not going to, at this point, if they allow spring training games at all, they're not going to allow a team to come in with a player who is a defector. So this is why MLB then turned to Tampa Bay and one other team. I forget who it was right now, but another team that did not have a Cuban defector on it at this particular point in time. So MLB has said, I've been talking about this, and they're kind of trying to prepare for it, but they don't have the okay of the Cuban government yet. And I think the Cuban government, again, doesn't quite know what they want to do about this. So I don't know. I mean, it could happen overnight, just like the Baltimore Orioles visit happened overnight back in 1999. It could be a couple of years before it happens. It's hard to say. It's hard to predict. As Yogi Berra once said, the future is very hard to predict, particularly the part that hasn't happened yet.
Peter Bjarkman, we've reached the end of the hour. How can fans reach you?
They can reach me through my personal website, bjarkman.com. That would be the easiest way, and my email is listed there, so they can get in touch with me that way. Or if they're in the area, as you mentioned, I'll be there in December. If they'll stop by, I'm glad to chat in English or Spanish with anybody after my presentation, and I look forward to seeing the people here in Sarasota.
Thank you very much, Peter Bjarkman. Looking forward to seeing you right here in Sarasota on December 6th.
Well, thank you for having me.
in Sarasota, Sunny Day, December 6th, PM, what December 6th, 2 p.m., at the Fogarty Hill.
Ring a lady and ya don't wanna carabali.
Esa música que heredamos, hijos y nietos de los africanos, la que mezclamos con la española, con la francesa y la portuguesa, la que fundimos bien con la inglesa, por eso decimos que es una sola, linda con rumba y rock, mambo con conga y pop, salsa con Mozambique y Caribe, cumbia con gas con swing, solo con samba y beat, merengue con bomba y son.
Mala, se pone la cabeza mala.